Case number 85369, Sierra Health versus Sandra Eskew, I believe is how that's pronounced. Are you ready to proceed? Counsel, come on up. And would you like, so we have 15 minutes per side for this argument. Would you like to reserve any time for a rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 3 minutes, please.
Okay, and so just so it's clear, the full 15 minutes is on the clock. When it gets down to 3 minutes, you'll get the yellow light and a tone to remind you it's now time to sit down. But if you're still standing there, the clock keeps going down to zero eventually. All right, go ahead then.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Tom Dupree on behalf of the appellant. We are here today challenging a $200 million damage award arising from an insurance coverage determination. We determined that as of 2016, proton beam therapy was neither a medically necessary nor proven treatment for lung cancer. Our determination was based on the plain language of the insurance contract. It was faithful to the determinations of the nation's leading medical, scientific, and radiological organizations, and it was consistent with the policies followed by every major insurer in the United States, as well as every single court to have addressed that question. There's no basis in this record for finding of bad faith, let alone to justify awards of non-economic and punitive damages that each exceed by many multiples the largest prior awards ever upheld in the history of this state. Let me begin with the first question before this court, which I think is really all this court needs to consider in order to resolve this appeal. And that question is whether we, Sierra Health and Life Insurance Company, had a reasonable basis for making the coverage decision that we did. Here, I think there were
the question that was up to the jury to decide.
Well, that question certainly went to the jury, Your Honor, but it is our position that we are entitled to judgment as a matter of law because this record does not permit a conclusion that we lacked a reasonable
basis. So there's no evidence at all in the record from which the jury could reach that conclusion.
That we lacked a reasonable basis? That's correct. In other words, the plaintiffs have argued, they say, well, for example, our treating physician and our expert witness testified that proton beam therapy would have been proven and medically necessary. But even accepting their characterization of the state of the science in 2016, even accepting that and looking at it in light most favorable, at the very most, all that would have established is the existence of a reasonable disagreement in the scientific community as to the efficacy and safety of proton beam therapy in 2016, and the existence of a reasonable disagreement defeats a bad faith claim as a matter of law.
Now, the policy covered radiation therapy, right?
The policy covered therapeutic radiation treatment, but provided that it is determined as authorized by the plan. In other words, if medically necessary.
Proton therapy is radiation treatment, right?
Yes.
Radiation therapy.
Yes, but as medically authorized, Your Honor, and that's the critical issue here. In other words, the contract by no means, and I don't think the plaintiffs are taking the position that it offered a blanket coverage of a proton therapy. I don't think that's remotely a reasonable reading. The contract states expressly that it is subject, as I think pretty much all commercial health insurance policies are, to a medical necessity limitation. And I think that's where the parties have engaged here. And it's our position that when the court looks at our proton policy, which is in the record, it's a 25-page single-space document that canvasses the medical literature. It looks at the determinations by the nation's leading organizations, including AHQA, including ASTRO, which are the very organizations that the Nevada legislature directed health insurers to look to and to be guided by in making medical necessity determinations. In addition, we could and did look to the policies followed by all the major insurers in the United States, covering approximately 80% of Americans. Not a single one reached a conclusion any different than we did. In fact, during trial, our expert testified without rebuttal that he was unaware of any commercial health insurance policy available in the United States in 2016 that would have covered proton therapy.
Plaintiff's expert testify that that conclusion that this is not a medically necessary treatment in this circumstance was based on a misreading of the medical literature.
That has been their position. And again, I don't think there is.
The expert testified to that.
The expert testified that in his view, it was medically necessary. And in his view, the literature supported his view. But I would submit to this court, and this court can look, again, the record is undisputed that these leading medical organizations, the state of the science.
Sure, there's a disagreement.
Sure.
Can't the jury resolve that disagreement and say, we don't think that it was reasonable to conclude it was medically necessary?
But Your Honor, if there is a reasonable disagreement in the scientific community, the existence of a reasonable disagreement, which we don't think anyone can seriously dispute here, at a minimum, there was a reasonable disagreement.
I think people can dispute it.
That there was a reasonable, Your Honor, I'm not aware of any scientific organization that in 2016 said that this is medically necessary and proven. I don't think there's any medical organization that says it. In fact,
if there was a reasonable disagreement within the scientific community, didn't the gentleman and his wife seek an insurance policy to cover proton beam therapy?
Mrs. Eskew testified that when she went on the market to buy an insurance policy, that was her goal. However, I would make a few points in response to that line of argument, Your Honor. The first is that this is not a lawsuit for fraud in the inducement. In other words,
I understand that.
Yes.
But when you're talking about a reasonable jury's interpretation of what took place in the denial of proton beam therapy for somebody that sought an insurance policy to cover proton beam therapy, do you not think that that makes their decision a little different than just saying it's a reasonable scientific disagreement over whether it should have been covered?
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor, because I think ultimately the question simply is, what did the policy say? And in reaching the coverage decision that we did we have a reasonable basis for reaching the conclusion we did? I would submit that in every bad faith case, at least the plaintiff is going to allege, well, I thought this was covered. I mean, that's their position. And that in and of itself can't possibly be sufficient to determine whether or not there was bad faith. What courts have looked at is they looked at, again, the state of the science, which at a bare minimum establishes a disagreement. In fact, all the science was on our side, but at a minimum, there was a disagreement. The disagreement defeats any bad faith claim. Second, the policies of all other insurers is the classic hallmark of reasonableness. When every single insurer reaches the same conclusion, even if we were wrong.
The insurance companies decide the standard for insurance companies? Is that your position?
Your Honor, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that the question before this court is the reasonableness of our decision. And the relevance of insurance industry practice is that it is a classic metric and yardstick for reasonableness. In other words, if we were in a world, which we're not, where the 11 other major insurers all said, yes, proton beam therapy is medically necessary, surely this court would say, well, that's a relevant data point that you are acting unreasonably. Here, of course, the record is 180 degrees the opposite. Everyone agreed. Everyone took the same position. I will also point out that the courts, the federal courts in Nevada, and looking at bad faith claims, look at whether any court in what they say is a controlling jurisdiction, i.e. the state of Nevada, has said this is a medically necessary treatment. That's what they look to. In this case, you know how many courts there were as of 2016 that said this is medically necessary treatment? The answer is zero. Zero in Nevada, zero in the United States. In fact, every single court that had reached that question agreed with us. And again, could it be said that all those courts, all the insurers, all the scientific organizations were all wrong, and that in fact it is medically necessary and proven? Even if that could be said, how could you possibly say that we lacked a reasonable basis when we looked at what everyone else in the world and the scientists and the doctors are saying?
The proton beam therapy was a big deal back then. It was discussed, according to you, in a lot of jurisdictions. Do these policies exclude that specifically?
The policies say that our proton policy does exclude specifically. I mean, it's not technically.
The policy that they obtained excluded proton beam therapy?
The policy they obtained, it excluded it to the extent that it is unproven, but it also fell outside the definition of medically necessary.
But
Go ahead.
The policy covered therapeutic radiology, right? If we understand that that's what she was seeking proton therapy. Is there anything in the face of the policy that said internally you had already determined that you would not accept it? An evaluation based on her case. This was an internal decision that had already been made when she got the policy that we're not doing that.
Right, Your Honor, I guess the first part of Your Honor's question, the remainder of that requirement about therapeutic services being covered, it's as deemed medically necessary.
But you had already determined that proton therapy was never going to be, at that point in time, was never going to be determined to be medically necessary.
For lung cancer, that's right, yes. And the policy
when he had at the time they purchased the policy.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Right.
And I would point out that the policy says that we can and do maintain internal policies, which, by the way, are number one, publicly available on the internet, or you can, you know, obtain them from the company, addressing, you know, specific conditions, specific medical necessity determinations. This is not at all.
Agents also have that information available when they're writing the policies, correct?
It's publicly available information, Your Honor. And the point is again, to get back to the gist of this.
Sorry, what's publicly available?
Oh, the policy about lung cancer not being covered, proton therapy for lung cancer not being medically necessary.
Policies are publicly available?
That's correct. It's undisputed. It is available. I'm publicly available.
Thank you.
But I guess my point also is that the questions about what she thought she was buying, again, there's no allegation of fraud in the inducement. None whatsoever. In fact, the trial court specifically excluded any evidence or testimony on the pre-contractual communications between Ms. Estee and the agent about what she was buying, because the district court correctly recognized that's not relevant to a bad faith claim. So I would submit to this court that I don't think the jury verdict can be upheld based on a theory about, you know, fraud and inducement, or what she thought she was buying, or was she misled. That wasn't submitted to the jury, and in fact was actively excluded from consideration at this trial.
So it wouldn't be bad faith to sell the policy to someone who has lung cancer, is buying it for purposes of the treatment for that lung cancer, have a policy that says it covers this kind of treatment, and not disclose that there's already a policy that it's never going to be covered for lung cancer.
Well, that can't
be bad faith.
Well, if you plead a fraud in the inducement, yes, but bad faith, no. Bad faith is, as the court knows, bad faith is a form of a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
Right.
A tort of bad faith concerns what happens after the moment of contracting.
Right.
The hypothetical Your Honor posited may well give rise to a claim for fraud in the inducement, but that wasn't pled in this case. That's not what they're arguing. That's not what they presented to the jury. That has absolutely nothing to do with the basis on which the jury found us liable, the claim that actually went to the jury.
Was there a judgment as a matter of law filed below?
Yes, Your Honor.
I missed that, both
pre and post, but yes, Your Honor.
And can you just talk to me a little bit about the amount of damages? I see your time is clicking down, but I do want to get to that issue because you started your presentation today with the unprecedented jury award.
Yes, the amount of damages would be, let's see, clearly excessive. As we put in the record, these numbers are just astronomical, way above and beyond anything that Nevada courts have ever approved in history. We think that both the compensatory and the punitive damage award need to be substantially reduced. We think they need to be reversed entirely. This is clearly a verdict. The amounts of these awards are shocking and clearly indicate that the jury was influenced by passion and prejudice. So under Rule 59F, this court has the duty, if it determines that a verdict of excessive damages that may appear to have been influenced by passion and prejudice, a new trial is required. We would submit that if these shocking numbers don't satisfy that appear to be the product of passion and prejudice standard, the rule would be a dead letter. I will reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you, counsel.
Good morning. Deepak Gupta on behalf of the Eskew family. Thank you, and may it please the court.
Before you get going, I just want, it's not a complicated question. Are you doing the entire argument, or are you
yes,
splitting
right.
it? Okay, go ahead.
As I think the Chief Justice's questions to my friend suggested, there's a question about whether this issue was a matter for the jury. And I would submit that in Nevada and in every jurisdiction that we've been able to determine, this question of medical necessity would be a question for the jury. And I think what we just heard is an effort by Mr. Dupree to retry the case on appeal. The jury's verdict should be upheld for at least three reasons. First, the verdict was based on substantial and indeed overwhelming evidence, evidence that Sierra violated its good duty of good faith and fair dealing when it summarily denied Bill Eskew's request for coverage without any investigation, denying him the treatment he needed, and leaving him to predictably and unnecessarily suffer an agonizing end to his life. Second,
saying that he should have known that proton therapy would have been available, the policies I guess stuff was posted on the internet.
So when he was asked at trial, when Dr. Ahmad, the medical decision maker, was asked, how would someone know about this corporate medical policy on lung cancer? He wasn't able to say how anyone would know. It wasn't disclosed to Sandy Eskew at the time she got the policy. The policy covered, as your question suggested, therapeutic radiology services. She procured the policy solely for the purpose of covering proton therapy. And so what they should have done, if they wanted to exclude it as a contractual matter, is listed as a contractual exclusion.
Which the contract did list certain things as being specifically excluded.
Yes, exactly.
Not proton beam therapy.
Exactly. And so what you have in this case is a kind of hidden exclusion. The policymaker at the time of entering into the contract has no idea that the coverage is excluded.
But wouldn't that be fraudulent inducement?
It could be a fraudulent inducement claim, but I think it's also relevant. This isn't our principal submission, but it is relevant to bad faith. And there was an instruction that was given to the jury that Sierra didn't object to, and they're not complaining about it on appeal.
But wasn't there a motion in limine that was granted at the outset of the case or before the case went to trial that that issue was not in play? The understanding pre-policy purchase of what that policy covered.
Yes, it was motion in limine 3, and I want to be clear about this. What the district court was saying is that evidence can't come in as parole evidence for interpretation of the contract, but she said, quote, nothing prohibits Mrs. Eskew from discussing her belief based upon the reading of the policy and the steps she took to secure coverage. And so she can testify to what coverage she believed she was seeking. So we didn't violate the motion in limine, and that's the purpose for which it came in, not for parole evidence.
Related to that, do you dispute that the corporate policy excluding this form of therapy for lung cancer as opposed to other kinds of cancer was available on the internet?
There's no way that the policy insured would have known that, but it is true. I guess there's nothing in the record that establishes conclusively that it was available on the internet at that time. It is available now.
Because they cite it as if it were in 2016 available on the internet, and I don't see any contest on that. And it seemed to me, because of the order in limine, that wasn't developed. That's a bit problematic.
Well, I don't think so, because the principal submission of the case and the way the case was tried to the jury was not that this is a fraudulent inducement or misrepresentation case. It was about the reasonableness of Sierra's determination. And if I may, I'd like to turn to that because I think it's the crux of this
case. And when you discuss that, could you please address your colleague's citation to the law where it says that if there's evidence to support both conclusions, that's exactly the sort of genuine issue and dispute and coverage that defeats a bad faith insurance claim. Would you dispute that reasonable minds could have differed at that time in 2016 as to whether or not this was medically necessary treatment?
I think, as I'd like to develop, I think the overwhelmingly correct medical and scientific conclusion was the one that Dr. Liao, the treating physician, reached. She was an eminent, world-renowned radiation oncologist. Her testimony was backed up by Dr. Chang, also an eminent radiation oncologist. And the only witness that Sierra put up to contest that testimony was their expert, Dr. Kumar. He had never treated anyone with proton therapy, had never worked in a proton center, had never published any research on proton therapy. If there is a person with the relevant expertise in proton therapy anywhere in the world who believes that Dr. Liao was wrong in her conclusion, Sierra did not find that person and did not present that person at trial.
Was there a medical literature out there on which they could base their conclusion and then say there's a reasonable basis, so it's not bad faith? Maybe there's coverage, but it's not bad faith.
Yeah, that's exactly what the trial was about, Chief Justice Kadish. And I think the problem for Sierra is that when that was subjected to scrutiny, it didn't withstand scrutiny. So even the studies that were cited in Sierra's own policy contradicted the conclusion they reached. The policy cited a peer-reviewed clinical study finding that, quote, proton therapy when used on lung cancer patients resulted in only a 5% rate of severe esophagitis versus a 44% rate for IMRT. And that's at Joint Appendix 3118. That's the Sedgepol study. The corporate policy itself said that proton therapy, quote, may be useful when the target is in close proximity to one or more critical structures. And I want to be really clear about this, because what you heard from Mr. Dupre is it's kind of an all or nothing question. Is proton therapy okay for lung cancer? But what Dr. Leon said when she sent her letter of urgent medical necessity is that this was a situation in which proton therapy was essential because there was a tumor that was neighboring critical structures, and she predicted that there was danger to the esophagus. And under those circumstances, it was medically necessary. That's the question. And faced with that letter of urgent medical necessity, what did Sierra do? They had a decision maker who was shown at trial to be unqualified. He wasn't even a radiation oncologist. He didn't have the understanding of a first-year resident of radiation oncology, and that became apparent at trial.
But he wasn't the one that established the actual underlying policy, is he?
He was not.
And it had been the one that reviewed this.
Right. Sierra notably did
who
not.
Who was involved in developing their underlying policy?
We asked that question. We sought discovery on it. Sierra never put forward the person who actually developed the policy. They didn't put forward anyone responsible for its creation or development. And I think one reason for that is the policy itself was supposed to be a policy that left discretion to individual decision makers. Because if you don't do that,
can a jury even decide the reasonableness of whether this was medically necessary or not without considering that it apparently, by concession, was predetermined that it would never be covered?
Right, and that's the whole problem. That's not a defense to bad faith. It's proof of bad faith. What both sides' experts testified at trial, this is uncontradicted, is that it is insurance industry practice and consistent with the duty of good faith and fair dealing that there has to be a thorough investigation. And the jury was so instructed. I mean, I want to just make sure that I point out this jury instruction to you. That said, it is a violation of the duty and good faith and fair dealing not to conduct a thorough investigation. And seriously,
they can't do an investigation about use of proton beam therapy for lung cancer and determine it's just not warranted by the scientific evidence at this time. They have to
do a case specific determination. That is the law of good faith, and both sides' experts agreed on that. The jury was so instructed. They aren't contesting that instruction. And I also just think it's very important to point out that that's not just the common law, and it's not just the uncontradicted jury instruction. It's also Nevada statutory law. So in 1998, at the height of concerns about managed care, Assemblywoman Barbara Buckley sponsored legislation that became law that was intended to rein in managed care companies. And that statute, what it says, and it's NRS 695G.150, it says that a managed care insurer like Sierra, quote, shall authorize coverage when it is requested by the treating physician unless a contrary decision is reached by someone with the necessary qualifications and expertise who examines the medical records. That's exactly what didn't happen here. The whole trial was about that. And what actually happened is that this person who's not a radiation oncologist, who had about 80 cases that week to review, spent a matter of minutes on this, didn't look to see whether this was a case where there were critical structures that were threatened. He just followed the policy as if it were a dictate, and that's not even what the policy was intended to mean in the first place. It was a policy that was supposed to confer discretion, and the problem is no reasonable discretion was exercised here.
Can I just turn your attention quickly to the damages?
Sure, of course.
So your client was seeking $30 million in damages, I believe, originally, and ended up with a judgment in excess of $200 million. Two questions about that. First, was there any evidence of economic damages presented at trial or financial loss, number one? And number two, in terms of the amount, counsel makes the point in his brief that it was persuaded by passion, so it was more punitive in nature versus compensatory. So how do we deal with that?
So two quick responses, and I hope I can develop them. On the economic loss, I mean, the main point I'd want to make is just not the law of Nevada, and is not a good idea to impose the kind of draconian economic loss requirement that they are proposing you do for the first time. And this would be a particularly bad case in which
to. So you don't want us to follow California law on that?
I would like you I think you should follow Nevada law and the law of Colorado and Kentucky and Hawaii that have rejected that requirement. I think there's a dispute about what California law requires. I think they're misreading California law. So I'm happy to get into that question. And then on the question of whether or not there was passion and prejudice, and I think the argument really is that somehow these compensatory awards were really kind of punitive, that the jury was inflamed and that there's some punitive component. I think that's the best version of my friend's argument. There's some hidden punitive component to the award. That's precisely the argument that Sierra's counsel made to the trial judge at the close of phase one. And they had a suggestion. What they suggested is that the court clarify what the jury had in mind. If the jury had intended any kind of punishment with that first phase award, then it should award no further damages because there would have already been punitive damages. And the argument made by my friends on the other side was that that would cure any concern for passion or prejudice. And you can see that argument at Joint Appendix 2857, and you can see the curative instruction at Joint Appendix 3358. And here is the instruction.
But before we go to that, I want to understand what was the damages that were compensated for in the compensatory damage award.
Right.
Your friend on the other side says, and I'm quoting from the brief, plaintiff does not dispute that the use of IMRT rather than proton therapy did not affect the progression of Mr. Eskew's lung cancer. Is that true?
It's not. No, I don't think that's the case. I think there was overwhelming testimony from the same experts I mentioned, that he would not have gotten this grade 3 esophagitis.
Right, but my question had to do with lung cancer.
Yes, I understand.
And its progression.
But the point is that it weakens him. So,
but just, do you concede that his lung cancer progressed the same under both therapies, the therapy that was approved and the proton therapy?
No, I don't concede that. I mean, of course, it's a counterfactual, but I think the point I'm trying to make is that when you predictably give this radiation that is going to endanger these critical structures, what happens in this case is what predictably would happen, which is that the patient is weakened. And Mr. Eskew was weakened. He couldn't eat. He couldn't hold down any food. He couldn't have a single meal after he returned from those treatments. And with any patient, that is going to alter their ability to fight the cancer that's ravaging their body. Now, you know, it's not a wrongful death case. I do want to be clear about that. That wasn't the way it was tried, even though it was originally pled that way. But these damages were for excruciating and totally avoidable pain and suffering that Bill
associated Eskew, with the esophagitis, and I may be mispronouncing that.
Yes, associated with the grade 3 esophagitis. And this is a condition that can kill you. I mean, if the radiation was a little bit higher, it could have killed him, and it could kill someone else in the same circumstance. And this was the result of a deliberate corporate policy, which is why punitive damages were justified here. This is just.
Damages, the compensatory award was purely for pain and suffering associated with the esophagitis and the agony that he went through in his last year of life.
That's correct. And if you want to look at a case that, to address, you know, Justice Lee's question about how you assess the compensatory damages, I think first I'd look at Wyeth, which says that pain and suffering damages are uniquely within the province of the jury. That court in a footnote 10 says it's actually an abuse of discretion to do the kind of comparative analysis that my friends are urging on you. I'd also recommend a very recent decision from the New Mexico Supreme Court, the Manga case. That was a $40 million award for pain and suffering, if I may just finish the pain and suffering. And the court engaged in a very careful analysis of exactly the questions that are before you. So I think it's helpful. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Rebuttal? Just a few quick points. First, on the reasonable disagreement point, I would commend to the court's attention three cases from the federal district court here we cited in our briefs, Basu, Phillips, McCall. Each one of them says when there's a reasonable disagreement in the scientific community, an insurer cannot be liable for bad faith. That is this case. Second, Plaintiff's claim also fails for a separate reason, the question Justice Lee asked about economic loss. Plaintiff made no effort to prove economic loss. That is a well-settled requirement of a bad faith claim in California. Of course, this court typically follows and mirrors California's bad faith law, which it adopted. I think it would be unusual to break with California, particularly when federal district courts in this district have made a diversity call and said, we believe this is the law of Nevada, that you have to prove economic loss in a bad faith case. The plaintiffs have said, oh, well, we put in some evidence going to economic loss. That's not the test. The test is, did you prove it? They made no effort to prove it. They told that to the jury. And of course, there are no findings from the court, from the jury, from anyone that they actually proved economic loss. Third point on the passion and prejudice. The Supreme Court has said that the amount of an award is the biggest red flag indicator. That is abundantly present here, that a verdict is tainted by passion and prejudice. Look at the other indicators that Nevada courts have focused on. Were there arguments that appeal to the jury's passions and prejudices? We laid those out in detail in our brief. It was a torrent of improper arguments, inappropriate appeals to sympathy, prejudice, attacks on defense counsel, making personal vouching for the credibility.
Did you do the argument?
We objected to it, Your Honor. We objected to it repeatedly, and it kept happening. This court said in Miosi that when you have a case of repeated misconduct, that puts the case in a different box. Here, from beginning to end, again and again and again, day after day, they made those arguments. You look at the resulting verdict. Shocking. Off the charts. The state has never seen anything remotely like this. Those verdicts followed less than an hour after they completed their presentation. They also awarded even more than the plaintiffs asked for in closing argument. Yet another red flag indicator that courts have said indicates that a jury was swayed by passion and prejudice. Again, I would point out the Rule 59 standard. You don't have to find that it was influenced by passion and prejudice. It's simply that the verdict may have appeared to be so tainted. There's no question that's the case here. And we ask the judgment below be reversed.
I'm sorry. Just what do you say about the reasonableness or the soundness of the evidence to the contrary in terms of medical necessity for proton theory for lung cancer as was discussed by your colleague over here?
Sure. I mean, here's, as Your Honor knows, you read the proton policy, 25 single space pages, it sets forth the literature. There are about 12 to 15 studies, pretty much all of which said proton therapy is neither medically necessary nor proven. I would also note that in addition to those clinical studies, peer-reviewed studies, we have actual determinations by the nation's two leading medical organizations saying this is neither medically necessary nor proven. This is, I should note, this is the very organization that the Nevada legislature put in the statute saying insurers should look to this organization to make their medical necessity determinations. That's exactly what we did. Again, I respect that my friend Mr. Gupta and his experts disagree with it, but as far as whether we had a reasonable basis for reaching that conclusion, it's not a close question.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the excellent briefing and arguments in this case. This matter will stand submitted. We'll be in recess until the next call of the court.